Welcome to the Filmmaker Mixer podcast. I'm Jeff, and recently my co-host Andrew and I got to cover the Austin Film Festival, where we interviewed a lot of great writers and directors and actors. During the festival, we uploaded shorter versions of all of these conversations, and now, over the next few weeks, we are going to be uploading the longer versions of all of these conversations we had during the Austin Film Festival. So stick around, it's going to be a lot of fun. Hello, everybody. This is the Filmmaker Mixer podcast, and we are continuing our coverage of the Austin Film Festival. And today I'm chatting with Jack Martin. Jack is the writer and the director of the new film, Bolt from the Blue. So, Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
And you know, I got to say, I really, really liked your film. I thought it was a great balance between comedy and drama. You know, you pull on the heartstrings a little bit, and then you got a little wacky comedy in there. And I'm glad I didn't see your website. I saw the film before I went to your website, because one of my questions was going to be the vibe it has. That has sort of that 80s, 90s vibe. It's a little Marty McFly. And then I saw your website and I saw that that was, you know, intentionally what you were going for. So I thought, you know, you definitely pulled it off. So that being said, I'm curious, where did this idea come from? I guess let's make it a two-parter. For those people who haven't seen the film or had a chance to see the trailer, because I know it's just coming out, describe what the movie's about, and then, you know, explain how you came up with this idea.
Yeah, so essentially the film is about a guy up in Alaska trying to catch lightning and harness its energy to save the world from climate change. It basically looks at that story through the lens of this electrical engineer named Mia, who it works in Los Angeles. Like a lot of people I know, she's, you know, reaching the end of her 20s and she's overworked and undervalued and just on the edge of burnout. And she's kind of forgetting why she wanted to become an electrical engineer to begin with. And so her boss sends her up to Alaska to investigate, you know, this claim that this guy can catch lightning and it's going to be the next great renewable source of energy. And funny enough, I had this idea probably about a decade ago. I had written a short film that was 10 pages long about this guy who had been spending his entire life trying to chase storms and catch lightning. The big question is, how did this, you know, where did this originate? In many ways, there are just so many tiers of it, whether it's, you know, the fact that I grew up in Chicago and whenever there'd be a massive storm rolling in, I would open up my garage, pull out a folding chair and just sit there and watch it roll by. And I genuinely, now that I live in LA, I miss those days where storms would be coming in, because like there would be a window, like a 5 or 10 minute window where like all the moisture just gets sucked up. And anybody who's been in a storm, especially in the Midwest, you know, the smell in the air. It's just, it's that suspenseful, like, ooh, something exciting's coming. And I think, you know, there's something really beautiful about the fact that like, when it comes to weather and storms, it's so out of our control, as humans. I mean, we're pretty bad at predicting the weather. We try to do it a week in advance. And usually the day before it's like, oh, it's changing. And then of course, you know, on the grander scale of it all, I think, like a lot of people around me, you know, get filled with some existential dread when it comes to climate change. And it's a very scary thing. It's something that we as human beings haven't really had to deal with before maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago. And now, you know, younger generations are going to have to pay the price for older generations' actions. And rather, you know, when I looked at all these other movies and TV series that were looking at the future or, you know, talking about climate change, it's usually met with a lot of dread. And I'm just an optimist at heart. And I just felt like, you know what, we know the problems. We know, you know, that there are storms getting worse and there's flooding and there's droughts. Let's talk more about the solutions. And I went down the rabbit hole of just investigating what really, really smart people around the world are spending every waking moment working on, just like I spend every waking moment working on stories and films and trying to break into the industry. There are also amazing people, you know, doing this kind of work out there. And yeah, in many ways, I wanted to make a film that embraced my own journey as a filmmaker and trying to, you know, pursue this unimaginable dream of being a director. That's just like, you know, it's hitting a bullseye on a bullseye. It's a really hard challenge to, you know, to take on. And at the same time, like I wanted to create a beacon of hope for younger generations to walk out of this movie thinking, You know what? I think I want to go down the rabbit hole as well of doing research on this kind of technology. And if I inspire one kid to commit his or her entire life to being an electrical engineer and trying to solve problems when it comes to climate change, then I feel like I've done my job.
Sure. And I want to circle back. You said you grew up in Chicago?
Yes, sir. Yeah. I'm a little bit of a liar. Western suburbs, you know, Downers Grove, Illinois.
Yeah. Well, I grew up, Andrew, my co-host, which unfortunately couldn't be with us tonight. He's from Chicago. And I grew up in a little farm town. Do you know Kankakee?
Yeah.
You go down, you say what?
Just amazing. I haven't heard that town name in so long.
Yeah, if you drive south of Chicago down 57, you pass Kankakee. I was in one of those towns surrounded by soybeans and corn. So that's funny. But you also had a really great cast in the film with some recognizable faces like Kate Flannery and Matt Walsh. How did you get your cast?
Yeah, so funny enough, Kate Flannery was a cold reach out.
Really?
Yeah. So
through a casting director or just?
No,
we did. Kidding.
It was so funny enough. My friend Juliana, I put down as the casting director because Juliana is actually Matt Walsh's niece. I went to high school with her, and I've been friends with her for about 15 years. And funny enough, I knew that Matt was her uncle, and I just never got a chance to meet him.
Yeah, that's right. He's from Chicago, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's right. That's right.
And so it's so funny because, like, I know her dad really well, who's Matt Walsh's older brother. So funny enough, after 10 years of being together, my close friend Mitch and Juliana got married back in Chicago. It was almost like a high school reunion, and Matt was there. And I got a little drunk. I did a dance battle with his.
Congratulations on the wedding. Would you be in my movie?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I was talking to Juliana's dad, and I was like, "Oh, I've never met your brother." And I was like, "Oh, let me introduce you." I was like, "I don't want to bother him." He's like, "He's my younger brother. I'm gonna introduce you." And you know, I told him about the movie. Matt, you know, outside of being an actor, he's also a writer. He's also a director. He's done a lot of indie films on his own. And he was just the nicest guy, and he was very supportive. And he said, "Hey, man, you know, when you're shooting and you know, you need me, hit me up. Let's see if we can make it work." And he was more than happy to do it. I'm really grateful to have worked with him because he's just a creative and comedic genius.
That is awesome. And I really liked Kevin Michael Martin and Paige Gomez were, I thought, fantastic together. You know, Paige had this really nice sort of heartwarming vibe that balanced out Kevin's kind of, you know, wacky character. How did you find those two?
Funny enough, actually, Kevin is my brother. And
no kidding.
Yeah, Kevin is my brother. And then Paige is his wife.
Really?
In real life, yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so funny enough, actually, their wedding was a week before we shot this movie. So I literally was getting, I was just like drinking, having fun, giving the best man speech. And then literally the next day, I was packing up a bunch of bags, getting on a plane to fly up to oversee the construction and building of Sparky and location scouting and stuff. And then Kevin and Paige flew up the following week. So funny enough, when I was writing the script, Kevin and Paige were always in my mind. My brother Kevin and I mean, we have 30 years of shared film tastes and comedic sensibilities that I just kind of knew all the buttons to press with him. And crafting this character between me and him was really fun. It was just kind of pulling out all these little facets of different characters that Kevin's done. I mean, a lot of my sense of humor definitely stems from my brother Kevin. He's a funny guy. And then Paige, I mean, what you see is what you get. She is just a down-to-earth Southern girl who, you know, has a strong backbone but a kind heart. And I knew we needed kind of the quote-unquote straight man to bring us into the story, somebody who could kind of ground everything and we could rally behind. So I knew she was going to be just killer as the role.
So you got Matt at a wedding, and Kevin and Paige were married before the shoot. What wedding did you find Manny Spiro at?
Funny enough, Manny, I believe we were connected through a friend, my friend Portia Juliet. He actually went to University of Southern California. I did as well, but he was a couple years behind me. And funny enough, after Portia recommended him, suddenly everybody was like, oh, Manny's great. Oh, you don't know Manny? Manny's the best. And he's another guy that, like, what you see is what you get. He's just such a kind human being, great energy. Everyone likes him. And, you know, as you can see from the movie as well, like, his performance packs a punch.
Oh, yeah, it's good.
Yeah, he, funny enough, I've kind of found one of my favorite questions with audiences, like, oh, who's your favorite character? And everyone kind of says different people, but I feel like the most unanimous one has been Manny.
Or, interesting.
As Clem. And I think it's because he's a little bit of like the sidekick underdog who has quite the arc throughout the story. So, yeah.
And this was a present day movie, right?
Yes, this takes
place. Okay, I thought so, because I was going to say, I love the fact that he's using that giant clunker video camera. I thought that was a nice choice.
Yeah, they're funny enough. A lot of Clem's costumes and the camera and everything like that, we went, my production designer and costume designer, Abby Mariyama, and I went down the rabbit hole of just all the backstory for Clem. We imagine like he lives with his grandma. He doesn't have a lot of money. He found that camera on this like small little, you know, Salvation Army and was like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. It makes me want more of an auteur.
That's funny. So I want to ask you something else. Maybe I'm crazy. And if you want to talk about it, great. And if you don't, I don't want to give any secrets away. But there was something about your opening shot that was very, that opening aerial shot was very, what's the word I'm looking for? It had kind of a magical quality to it. And I thought, you got to be doing something other than just a drone shot. Was there something else going on there?
I mean, all the clouds in that shot are fake. Those are all visual effects.
But it had this sort of like the way the focus racked between around some of the like the Jeep or whatever the car was there and the trees. It almost looked like you did sort of it almost looked like a miniature, but it wasn't a miniature, if that makes sense. Am I crazy?
Interesting. Funny enough, no effects are applied to that.
That's actually wild.
Yeah, that's just me operating a Mavic 2 Pro. I do have an anamorphic adapter on it, and that might probably help, because anamorphic adapters kind of warp the sides of a frame a little bit and kind of blur the frame in a different way than, you know, normal spherical.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was, because I thought it looked really, it was interesting and cool, and it looked really magical to me. I thought it was a great opening for the film. And speaking of all that, I know you shot in Alaska, which is amazing. I watched your location scouting video, and I'm curious, did you choose Alaska? My question is two things. One, was Alaska in the script, or did you find the location and then build the story around it? And then the second thing is, you know, when you were scouting in Alaska and you found, you know, great things like that, that shipyard, did you rewrite things in the, script to be able to utilize new locations that you found?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is, I'm a big fan of resourcefulness, not resources. And so when I originally wrote the short film 10 years ago, I actually wrote it to take place in Colorado because my uncle Bob had a house there for a little while. And it was always going to be Lightning Valley, because Lightning Alley is actually a real space in Florida where it's like in a certain mile radius. It's the point on the surface of the earth where the most lightning strikes hit. And I was like, all right, I think mountains are way more cinematic. So I'm Lightning Valley. But we kind of the main reason why I picked up this story again is because my producer, Mike, reached out to me and he said, hey, I love your work. We should work together. And I turned around and said, yes, Mike, I've been wanting to work with you for years. And he is actually from Homer, Alaska. And so he was like, hey, man, like, let's write around Alaska. And I was like, well, I have this story from Colorado. I think it's even better if it's in Alaska. And when we went up there, I was just blown away. Like, Homer, Alaska is one of the most gorgeous places on the entire earth. And I've been to a lot of different countries, and I was just, there's a reason why people visit Homer and just never leave. That's kind of how that town has become populated. And so, when we were running around, I mean, probably 70 to 80% of the movie was filmed around that cabin. And it might not seem that way. Like the strike zone is actually like a quarter of a mile away from that cabin. So that kind of helped us, you know, stay around the same space. We actually only shot on the spit, which is that little peninsula of land that goes out into the water in the downtown area and like the docks. We only filmed around there for about 3 days. And then everything else was pretty much around the cabin. And yeah, like for instance, the shipyard, when we scouted there, I was like, well, we have to put these boats in there because that's the coolest thing ever. These are just giant boats. And we actually tried to film in between them and we got approval. And then when we showed up on the day, they were like moving a bunch of stuff around. And the guy was like, hey, sorry, you actually can't film here, but you can film on like the outer rim of it. So I can't even remember if you can tell in the film, but I was so disappointed because I was like, oh, you can see the cones of the perimeter. So everyone's going to know that we're filming outside of this location. But yeah, I mean, it was very much trying to build up the character of Alaska as remote as possible. Because I felt like the further out it is and the more remote it feels, the crazier yet more justified Lucas's character is, because he's not jaded by the outside world and society. And yeah, and like Kolik Island is what it's called in the film. It's not really an island, but I thought it'd be cooler to make it an island.
Well, it looks awesome. I mean, it's beautifully shot, and when you can make your location a character in the film, it's obviously a good thing for sure. So I want to circle back to something else. You know, when you were, you know, you said you wrote it as a short, then developed it as a feature screenplay. I'm curious what your writing process is. You know, Austin is a writer's festival, and we do get a lot of questions on the podcast. You know, some people are, beat sheet people. Some people are, you know, just kind of use a more freestyle with their ideas. Do you have a process you use when you write?
I do. Yeah. I've learned, I believe in many ways, there's like two different kinds of writers. There's architects and there's gardeners. And I think I've learned I'm a little bit more of a gardener.
explain what you mean by that.
Well, an architect, you kind of have to map out every single thing from the beginning, as opposed to a gardener, you plant some seeds and you kind of see how it grows, and then, oh no, this isn't growing as well. All right, I got to tend to the soil a little bit. You're constantly taking it day by day with still a general plan of what you want your garden or your patio or your backyard to look like. Knowing that also, you know, if you have enough patience in the long run, it will grow into something. And you have this vision for what it'll look like. And as somebody who likes to garden too, I've learned like, oh man, this bougainvillea is going to look great in the backyard. And then after a couple months, I'm like, bougainvillea died. All right, we're pivoting to something else. So usually what I do is I try to write a treatment, which my treatments are, I try to keep them between 8 and 12 pages long. And the first two pages are summaries. So it's like the first page, what I do is I actually do 5 posters of movies that are similar in style and tone. I'll do like an entry paragraph to kind of like set the mood, then a log line, a paragraph kind of explaining the first act, themes and tone, and then like characters and what their arcs will be. And then the next 8 pages is, you know, basically an elongated Wikipedia explanation of what happens. And what I do with that is, you know, that's just like, you know, me as a kid playing with Legos on the floor. Like, you just have to be so open-minded and free-spirited and not judgmental and just explore different versions of, you know, what this story could be. And it could be, you know, some sections are super specific. I'm like, I know exactly what this scene is. And you read a paragraph and you're like, bam, that's well written. And then other paragraphs are super vague of like, and then this happens and this character goes that way. And now we're in the third act. And I'll do that. And I'll do like 10 or 12 versions of the treatment. The first couple are just for me, and then every version afterwards, I have a tier of like friends and collaborators that I get notes back. And then usually I've learned, it's one of those things like, once you get to a pretty good place where you're like, listen, I could keep, you know, finding every little detail in this treatment, or I could acknowledge that once I jump to script, this is going to completely change. And it's kind of like, you know, as they say, you make three different movies, one when you write it, one when you shoot it, one when you edit it. In many ways, like, it's like three and a half, because the half is like the treatment. The treatment is such a general, you know, it's like a vague painting that you're like, okay, I drew this, what I think the painting will be on like an, you know, sheet of paper, but I can't get much detail. Now the script is a little bit bigger of a canvas. It's 2 feet by 3 feet, you know, so you can add more detail. And then of course, when you shoot it, it's like a 6 foot tall canvas. So it's just getting bigger and bigger, but you can't jump to that. For me personally, I can't jump directly to a script. You know, that's pretty scary. Cause the key thing as well is like, when you start writing your script, you better finish it no matter what. And the key thing is for me, I'm like, if you get to page 80 and you haven't figured out what your third act is, then that's pretty stressful. But if you know, like, you know, some days you wake up and you're like, man, I'm not in the mood to write, but I got to write these 5-8 pages, whatever your goal is for that day. You know, the good thing is you can kind of lean on your treatment and be like, oh, okay, this happens. I'll write the bad version of this. And then tomorrow I can reread it. So, and every day also, I see writing a screenplay as like sweeping a floor, where, you know, first day I write pages 1 through 8, you know, second day I'm not starting on page 9. I'm actually rereading pages 1 through 8, rewriting them a little bit, and then trying to get 9 to 12. And then the next day I'll read pages, you know, 5 to 12, and then get, you know, start really writing 13 to 18. And, you know, in many ways, that's like sweeping a floor. You're always kind of going back for a little bit of that debris that you left behind, hoping to get a really clean floor. And then it's, you know, the same thing. I think this script went through about 12 drafts until, in many ways, I had the same thing where I was like, well, this is as good as it's going to get for right now. And I think I'll probably have some changes when I'm shooting it. And in many ways, I don't know what needs to change fully until I'm on set on the day, building props, costumes, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And, you know, this is 3 years ago, is when I started writing the treatment, and here I am, you know, trying to get the movie out there. So it's a long journey.
Wow. Wow. And when you're writing, you know, when you decided to take an idea and turn it into a screenplay, do you know where you're going? At least, like, do you know what the end of the movie is going to be? Do you know where you're going, or do you start with a situation, and then try to figure out, you know, try to let the ending come organically? I mean, I've talked to writers who do both. I know one writer, he's like, if he doesn't know the end of the movie, he doesn't start. And then there are others that, like, I love this situation and I love these characters, but I don't know what's going to happen, and they figure it out as they go. Do you do one or other or both?
I think I need to kind of know where I'm going in order to then throw that plan completely out the window. But I also admire writers who are like, no, I'm going to let the characters guide me, and I don't know where this is going to go. I think that's a very daunting pursuit. And in many ways, like I've been debating even trying that strategy out for my second feature, because, you know, if you surprise yourself or you don't know where you're going, then the audience doesn't either. And there's something to be said about that. As opposed to, for me, I wanted to make sure, at least from beginning to end, you know, in many ways I see Bolt as like a story around the campfire, or like a little book that you know, read to a kid at night. And I just wanted to make sure that the overall genre and tone and just feeling you get throughout the entire movie was cohesive. So yeah, in many ways I knew exactly kind of where it was going to end up. And I think that's also because this is very much potentially like a film that could have sequels. And I wanted to set up, you know, essentially close the book on this part of the character's journey while giving a hint of what could come next.
Right. Right. Makes sense. Well, I also know, when I was looking at your bio and your IMDb page, you know, you've got some award-winning shorts. You did Manhunt, which I thought looked really great. I'm curious, do you work with a lot of the same folks, you know, like DPs and producers? I mean, a lot of times people build their tribe around them and continue to work with them. Do you kind of stick with a lot of the same folks?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'd say every film I do, I usually pick up 1 to 2 new people. And then there are a handful of other people I'm like, oh, you are great. You know, whether their schedules are different, next project, or, you know, some people are like, I don't do film anymore. It's like, oh, okay. But, like, Yeah, I'm trying to think. Like Brian Tang, my DP, I'd worked with back in college, and my production designer Abby and I, we had actually never worked together in this capacity, but we were both production assistants on Godzilla versus Kong. My composer Xander has actually done all but like one or two projects of mine for the last decade. So he's, you know, a great collaborator. And then my VFX supervisor Kai was actually a you know, basically a newcomer on my team this year. And I'm genuinely so excited about not only my collaboration, but my friendship with him. He's, you know, just like all the collaborators I bring on, like he's just somebody who makes me better, as well as he's a director and storyteller in his own right. So what's great is I can give him a little direction, but then he can kind of run with it with his own vision and come back and, you know, kind of surprise me. So there's a lot to be said about, you know, having a team, a collective group of people that you have a deeper relationship with beyond just saying like, hey, you know, come do the job on this film and then I'll see you later. It's great to be surrounded by friends, especially when you're so stressed trying to do the awesome.
Well, it's also, you know, you build a shorthand with these folks, you know, folks you work with on a regular basis. You know, it's almost that finishing each other's sentences kind of example. You build this shorthand and you can work faster that way. And speaking of which, I wonder, what was your production schedule like? How many days did you shoot?
Yeah, so I believe we had scheduled 14 days in Alaska, which got extended to a 15th day. And then we had about a day and a half in Los Angeles. So in total, we were at about 17 days in total. Alaska was really tight. We actually, funny enough, the fourth day of shooting, the first 3 days were basically all in town, all the dock stuff, and the second day of shooting was actually 30 mile per hour winds. Everybody's faces were red with wind burn after day two. And day two was also like, we were basically faking that shipwreck. So that shipwreck, you know, you see in the film, it's VFX in any of the wides. And then we actually just took a boat on a trailer and my production designer and her team ran around scooping up a bunch of seaweed and dirt and just slapping it all over this boat. So right off the bat, we're like, all right, we're hitting the ground running. And then day four, we were supposed to shoot all like the climax storm stuff. And a huge storm came through where you couldn't even see like 10 feet in front of you.
Oh, wow.
And my production designer looked at me and she was like, why don't you just call that day off and then we shoot Friday, Saturday? And I was like, oh my God, that's a genius idea. And what's great is on Friday, the storm somewhat cleared up, but it was still an overcast day. And suddenly there was snow all over the mountains in the distance. And it wasn't.
Oh, wow.
So we were like, wow, that worked out very nicely. And then the following week is when Kate flew in and we shot her stuff out. And then the third week was as many interiors as possible, like, you know, Lucas's office and all that stuff. But yeah, it was funny. Actually, I kept asking all the locals in that first week, hey, when do you think the leaves are going to change? Hey, when do you think the leaves are going to change? And they were like, we don't know. And I was like, right. Yeah. I grew up in Chicago. Like it's different every year. It's super unpredictable. And then they kept being like, yeah, but you know, winter came early. It's cold. And I was like, yeah, no shit. Everyone on our team is freezing. So, that was pretty much the schedule. It was fast. It was go, go, go. A lot of, you know, working day and night. I think every night for a full month, I think I got about 4 hours of sleep, which was pretty normal.
Wow. And, you know, on independent productions like this, a lot of times, you know, you have to wear a lot of hats. Did you take on other jobs beyond directing and writing? I mean, you know, sometimes just, you know, I've been on shows where you've got a small indie crew and everybody's pitching in doing different things. Did you have opportunities to share roles with other people in different ways?
Absolutely. Yeah. So funny enough, I feel like one of the reasons why my production designer, Abby, agreed to do the movie was she was actually a little concerned that she would have enough time and prep because she was working on the Obi-Wan Kenobi show on Disney+. And I basically said to her, I was like, hey, I'm gonna help carry the weight. I'm gonna design all the costumes and stuff like that with you. I'm, you know, a lot of stuff like Lucas is wearing is stuff like I bought either from China or Amazon. And I bought like 10 different pairs of gloves for Lucas, and I tried every single one of them on to see which ones matched his jacket. And then I just returned the ones that didn't. And then like the beacon shooters are actually things that I designed with my prop master, Connor Hall.
No kidding. That's cool.
Yeah. So I spent, funny enough, actually, I spent a whole day painting the final beacon shooter different colors. And then I peeled off all the paint and I looked at it and I was like, no, it's wrong. I just knew. I was like, this is the wrong design. It was bright orange, like sparky. And I was like, this is the wrong design. And I spent literally another day on Photoshop designing it, and then another day painting it and putting it together, and then handed it off to my prop master, Connor, who then like wired it with all the lights and stuff. And so yeah, I mean, that's what I found from being a PA on a bunch of different shoots, like Godzilla vs. Kong and The Lion King and The Fargo Show, is like, I think most young up and coming directors want to meet and get to know the director. But in truth, what you really should be doing is meeting every other crew member and learning what their jobs are, because that's kind of how I felt like I could build these props and design all this stuff, is because I had seen, you know, how the costume designer designed all the costumes for Godzilla versus Kong. And, you know, the location supervisor told me stories of working with Michael Bay and Chris Nolan and Spielberg and how they all work, and how she then, you know, works for them and, you know, provides different locations and how she's got to work within a budget, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, in many ways, I was also like the location scout with my producer, Mike, and Bob Sika. And yeah, I think you have to, for your first film, you have to be able to wear as many hats as possible without, you know, killing yourself. And there were definitely some times where I was like, I am thinking about 1,000 different things. This is insane. But yeah, it was exciting.
And do you storyboard?
I don't, actually, funny enough. I feel like maybe... I think the reason why is I unless they're super detailed, I just think I've got it in my head, and two, when you're there on set, it always looks different. Yeah, and I don't have the money to pay for a good storyboard. I do overheads. I do obsessive overheads, like an architect would, where I just map everything out. And then, because the great thing is when you're on set, there's just no time to think. You need to have, it's like studying for a test. You need to know all the answers,
right?
But you also, you need to, you know, go in so prepared so that when, you know, your Steadicam operator is like, hey, I can't walk that way, I need to go this way, you can pivot really quickly and go, okay, yes.
So you map out, when you're doing your overheads, are you mapping out sort of block, you know, tentative blocking for characters and where you want the camera to go and where you see the lights? You know, I mean, is it that kind of design?
Yeah, I get pretty obsessive about it. I'll use like different color coded sharpies and highlighters, because it also has to be able to make sense when you show up to the DP and the production designer as well, because they also very quickly, I'd say half the time your actors will change stuff. They say, I don't feel like I would go that way, or they're like, you put the actors in the frame with the prop and they go, hey, the prop doesn't work like you thought it would. And you go, oh crap. And they kind of have to do. But then in many ways, like my production designer, Abby, and my DP, Brian, they both were like, for instance, we were actually going to totally build Lucas's office and lab from scratch. And then that lab is actually my producer's father's garage.
Oh, interesting.
And both of them basically called me when I was there before them, and they were like, why aren't we just using that as the set? And I was like, I'm a fool. How did I, why did I think we should just build it from scratch? It's so much work. So naturally when that happened, I had to, you know, all the overheads that I had sketched out, yeah, they kind of didn't really make sense anymore. And I had to completely re-choreograph where the characters would go. And that's the other hard thing too, is like, you know, there's a couple moments in every film that I do that I'm like, oh man, the staging or you know, the way the characters moved looks a little, you know, staged and directed. And that can kind of happen when you have so many moving parts and very little time.
Sure, sure. Well, I'm curious about one thing. I always like to ask people this question, creative people. Was there a defining moment for you as a child or a teenager where you knew you had to be a storyteller and a filmmaker? How did that happen for you?
Oh, wow. funny enough, I mean, I grew up in a household that was all guys. I'm the youngest of two older brothers, Kevin being one of them. And they, you know, it was a lot of testosterone and sports and all that kind of stuff in my home. And I love a good football game and all that stuff. I actually played 8 years of football, but I don't care that much about watching sports consistently. And I always kind of felt left out. And my mom was like, oh, why don't you, you know, go watch the game with your brothers and your dad. And I'm like, no, I'd rather watch, you know, SpongeBob on this small, you know, 1 foot by 1 foot little TV in the kitchen. I don't know. I think in many ways, I found growing up in the Midwest incredibly boring. I wanted my life to be eventful and exciting. And for me, the one way to do that was through telling stories that felt larger than life and bigger than me. I wasn't the best at, you know, a lot of the sports I played. I wasn't the best with school. I also didn't really like being told what to do or following rules. And the great thing with filmmaking is nobody could kind of tell me what to do. I was kind of the, you know, the leader of this world that I was building. You know, and things kind of worked out the way I wanted them to in this world. So naturally, like, your biggest dreams, you can kind of play out, you know, in stories, but also, you know, seeing how people reacted when I was making these stories and seeing it actually have a deeper impact felt like I was actually cutting through some of the, you know, facade of everyday life and actually finding a connection with people around me that, you know, they otherwise weren't finding. So, I don't know. I've always just loved escapism movies. You know, Pirates of the Caribbean, I think I saw that when I was probably like 7. And that movie just, oh no, I was totally older than that. I was like 12. Gosh. Pirates of the Caribbean, I that's one of my favorite movies. I just think it's near perfect on every level of its craft. But you know, Apollo 13 is another film that anytime it was on TV and my dad was flipping to channels, he would always be like, oh, we're watching this now. And I think those kind of stories of everyday people, you know, ordinary people pursuing extraordinary goals, I think is just incredibly admirable. And that's definitely the kind of stories I want to tell.
Well, it's a great film. As I said, I really enjoyed it. And are you an Instagram guy? I mean, if people want to see more of your work, obviously you've got the website, but do you have like Facebook page or Instagram or anything like that?
Yeah, everything's Jack Martin Film. So, you know, Instagram is at Jack Martin Film. I think Facebook is also / Jack Martin Film. And my website is jackmartinfilm.com. Good thing is Jack Martin is right under John Smith on the average scale of names. So it's not too hard to remember.
Again, it's a great movie. I think it's going to do well at the Austin Film Festival. And definitely, you know, circle back and let us know how distribution goes and keep us up to date on your future projects.
Amazing. Will do. Thank you so much, Jeff. This was great.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. And you take care, my friend.
All right, you too.
Thank you for listening to the Filmmaker Mixer podcast, a podcast created and hosted by filmmakers Jeff Stolen and Andrew Lamping and produced by Melody Lopez.
Our theme song was composed by Stephen D. Bennett.
Make sure to follow or subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to us on and stay tuned for future episodes.